The Forged and Unbroken podcast.
You're from Canada, and that's where a lot of your background is from, like educational side. Could you give us a quick rundown of just educational background and how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, so I'm from a city called Medicine Hat in Alberta, which is in the western part of the country. So I was born and raised there. I did my bachelor's degree at the University of Calgary, which is about 2.5 hours northwest of Medicine Hat. And then during my bachelor's degree, I played some football. And in playing football, I got exposed to the sport of Olympic-style weightlifting. And it was Olympic-style weightlifting that led me initially to come to Shreveport, Louisiana at first. So I was on the Canadian national team. And in 2011, I was invited to come to a training camp at a training center here in Shreveport under the direction of Dr. Kyle Pierce. While I was here for the training camp, Dr. Pierce asked me if I would be, you know, if I would want to come and train with the team and also complete my master's degree. So I completed my master's degree at LSU Shreveport. That was 2011 through 2013. Following that, while I was here, I met my wife, Morgan, and we ended up getting married in 13. We moved up to Canada because I really didn't have a job. I mean, I was, you know, I finished my master's degree. Well, actually, I did have a job. I was working as I was actually sewing up car seats. I was working at an upholstery shop.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and then my next job was, my whole family is in the construction business, so we were able to move up to Canada, and I started, you know, doing some construction, framing, concrete work, things like that. I eventually ended up getting a job at a local college because they needed someone to set up a metabolic cart and to teach an exercise physiology class. Well, my background was exercise phys, so I was able to set the metabolic cart up and then started teaching as an adjunct instructor. I eventually ended up getting a job there. I enjoyed teaching. I enjoyed research. So I decided to enroll in a PhD program at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. And I completed that in 2018. Following that, I came, there was a job opportunity at LSU Shreveport. I came down, I worked at LSU Shreveport as an exercise phys professor for 5 years. And then the last 2 years, I'm over at LSU Health, which is like the medical center. And I'm the director of the PhD program in rehabilitation science. And I also work in the Department of Family Medicine. But in terms of research, most of my research relates to heat stress, and specifically a lot of work has been done with firefighters.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And that's kind of how I started seeing your name pop up in the research when I started digging into what was out there to find out what we are metabolically under, the uncompensable heat stress in our gear. And there's so many factors where it is, it's environmental. They're just from maybe regional where we live, you know, we have to take that into account. And then the uncompensable effect of being in our gear. And then we also have the superheated environment. And then there's just the physiology of how we readily able we are to adapt, or maybe we don't have very good adaptations. So there's multiple facets of, that are hitting us about how we're going to be able to withstand and then perform in these environments. And so that's when I started seeing your name pop up, and it was really awesome. Just the findings that I was figuring out. So awesome rap sheet, number one, with the resume and educational background. You got your hands in a lot of different things. I love the strength and conditioning side as well. That's something that I've been in for, almost 15 years now as well, as like a side thing. So, you know, I see the benefits and the crossover. How is it that you got into the fire service and military circles?
Yeah, I got into, well, my PhD chair, she did firefighter testing, a lot of occupational testing, dragon hose and all that kind of stuff. And so we had access to, in Victoria, we had access to a lot of firefighters. So we decided to do some heat stress research, simply looking at, and I just asked a simple question. As I was looking through the literature, I saw that, a lot of the heat stress research assumed that if someone was at a core temperature of 38 degrees or 38.5 or 38 or 39 degrees Celsius, I mean, they behaved in a similar manner. And so I started thinking about firefighters, and I started to go, they're wearing non-permeable PPE. They have to be heating up much faster than you would if you went out, if you were exercising outside, for instance, in Louisiana in the summer, because there is literally, there is no capacity for thermoregulation. You just store heat. So I just asked a simple question. Well, what if they heat up quickly? Will that cause, exacerbated effects? Will that cause further complications? And so we just started looking at basic things. We wanted to look at cortisol. We wanted to see, is there an increased stress response? We looked at cerebral oxygenation. Was there changes in the prefrontal cortex in terms of oxygenation? We looked at EEG. We wanted to see, was there changes in brain waves with when someone heats up quickly? And turns out the answer was yes, yes, and yes. And so we started, and so that kind of led me down the path of trying to understand and trying to basically, state in the literature that rapid heat stress, or the rapid accumulation of the rapid uncompensable heat stress scenario, results in further complications. And then so I've looked at reaction time, I've looked at inflammation, I've looked at all kinds of different things, and it proves, I mean, there's my research has shown that across the board there seems to be this exacerbated increased effect when people are, again, wearing the PPE and heating up quickly, as opposed to just exercising outside when it's warm.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. My nerd flag is already like it's kicking hard right now because I want to dig into all these things. I want to understand the metabolic effects and the actual physical effects that we're feeling when we're in these superheated environments. And then as we get deeper into it, let's start breaking apart. I'm nerding out hard on the prefrontal cortex and the decision making under stressful conditions. There's a lot of things here I want to unpack in a short amount of time. So let's just start on the heat side of things. Let's talk about the physiological metabolic markers of core temp rise. There are things where I'm seeing, we hit core temps much faster. How we're able to tolerate hydration, dehydration, the rise in core temp, even when we exit these structures in these superheated environments. Most people think, okay, I'm safe now, but there's still, from what I'm reading, there's still a core temp rise even after egress, and how we manage that. And then let's get into how that affects decision making. So we'll start with just the vital sign aspects first.
Yeah, so in terms, you are 100% correct. When you pull a firefighter out of any hyperthermic environment, and that hyperthermic environment can just be, going to a vehicle call or something like that, where you're in full PPE or something like that. I mean, and that core temperature is going to rise fast. But you're right. Once the event stops, or once they exit the environment, their core temperature will still continue to increase for a period of time, and that's when you can reach these detrimental states. But all kind of, there's rapid increases in heart rate, there's rapid increases in respiratory rate, there is you name it, the physiological response is much higher when you can't thermoregulate. Because what happens is, our bodies, the way we thermoregulate mostly is via sweating and evaporation into the external environment. Well, as a firefighter, when you put on your PPE and you start exercising, or start, you go to a call, what happens is you start to generate metabolic heat. Well, the microclimate between you and the PPE is eventually becomes hot, and it eventually becomes high in humidity. So what happens is all, you know, early on, the core temperature moves to the periphery, increases the skin temperature, so on and so forth, as you are trying to expel heat. Well, eventually what happens is it basically, the ability to thermoregulate hits a wall, and you can't thermoregulate any further because the microclimate has reached a hyperthermic state, and it's high in humidity at that point. So you can't thermoregulate. So what happens is the skin temperature starts to skyrocket. Mm. Okay, skin temperature starts to go really, really, really high, and even higher than core temperature. Mm. So really, there's a barrier at that point. Core temperature tries to move towards the skin, but it runs up against the hyperthermic skin temperature, and really there's no capacity for exchange at that point. And so that really is the major problem. Obviously the extreme heat that firefighters work in when they go into a structure fire or something like that, that plays a role, but the real detriment when we talk about heat stress is the metabolic heat and the inability for that metabolic heat to escape.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, when we do exit the structure, there's a couple rabbit holes I want to go down. We always talk about cooling techniques and how we do that safely. So many of, and I want to bring in the Mayday side of this because that's where a lot of my interests lie. When we're bringing firefighters out, 50% of our line of duty deaths are cardiac. Just Mayday scenarios, one of the top five reasons are medical. Because of heat stroke, heat exhaustion, a subset of that is even, diabetic episodes. And so I want to hit two things really quickly. First is, what are proper cooling techniques when we are having core temps well over 100, approaching 104, even greater, when things are really starting to be detrimental? And sorry, I know that's Fahrenheit. I'm learning Celsius as we go along with this. I'll start with this. I have heard, and I'm trying to find specific research on it. I have heard that, you know, one of the quick things that we do is like forearm immersion, ice packs under like groin and armpits, also stuff around the neck. I've heard though that the neck is actually more like tricking the thermostat. So it would almost be like an equivalent of putting ice or a fan in front of the thermostat. You're tricking the system, but you're not actually cooling the actual environment. So that's my one toss up. And then the other being, one, can you confirm or dispel that? And then two, what are going to be the cooling techniques that are truly going to help us when we do leave these environments? I know like cool IVs is another one.
Yeah, there are all kinds of ways that you can cool down. Obviously, if someone gets to like a heat stroke level, then they need to be immersed. Right? Yeah. You need to have a cold tub or something like that. Yeah. You need to into that as quick as possible. Now, in terms of cooling, yeah, one of the most common things is putting your hands in ice water or something like that and cooling the wrists. That also works well. I published a paper last year looking at what areas of the body get the hottest following PPE heat stress or firefighter heat stress, and it's the neck, it's the head, the neck, and like the upper chest. So, I mean, if you're going to address specific areas, I mean, those would probably be good areas to kind of start to address because they get so hot. I mean, the neck, I mean, it's highly vascularized. So, I mean, you're going to, if you can cool down the blood a little bit, right, that's going to help because it's going to move through the system. But, I mean, it all depends on the level of hyperthermia, mm-hmm. I guess.
Yeah.
And here's one of my biggest I don't want to say beefs, but one of my biggest problems with heat stress is that it's all reactive, right? Everyone is reactive when it comes to, someone comes out of a fire or someone comes out of a hyperthermic environment and they're confused and things like that. And they go, okay, well, they may have heat stroke, and so we need to do this and this and this and this. What I've been doing recently, I just published a paper a month ago. I've been looking at core temperature prediction. Mm. And so what I do is I collect physiological metrics and I run various, and I create algorithms from those, and those are used to predict core temperature. Such actually to the point that now we have a patent filed to integrate a system and a core temperature predictive algorithms that are developed using machine learning. And these predict core temperature really, really well. So my goal is to, you know, be able to create devices, for instance, like an armband or something like that, that a that firefighters could wear, that would be used to predict core temperature very accurately, because when you use machine learning, right, the algorithms become stronger over time as you add more and more and more data in.
Yeah.
So instead of being reactive, we could be proactive in that the core temperatures, you know, and you can tell me if this would work or not, but if the core temperatures of every individual who's in the structure could be displayed on an iPad, and you could see that John Smith is in there and his core temperature is, you know, 104, 105 or something like that, or even let's just say 102, and you can tell that their core temperature is elevating, would it not make more sense to potentially pull them out before they reach these hyperthermic states, as opposed to dealing with it from a reactive standpoint? And I'm not sure how that would work in firefighting. I know that, you know, when you guys go in, the major reason why people will leave is because of the air alarm, right?
Yeah, typically if there's no red flags because of fire conditions, one of the immediate withdrawals would be once we hit a certain low air alarm. Yeah, we start to exit for sure.
Yeah, and so I always think, I've been thinking, you know, could they wear a device, and once they reach a level of heat stress, could we not pull them out and replace them so that they don't have the impact of heat illness? So I mean, that's kind of where I've been going recently.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. There's certain, and I've benefited from, let's just say, the metabolic trackers, like even just Apple Watch and Whoop data, to see what we're under when we're under the physical, emotional stress, and the data that we're collecting from that has been amazing. And it is somewhat subjective. So we have objective data, but it's subjective in that you now have to overlay the person's experience level. Not just experience in years, but also their expertise and their tactical acumen, and then their physical fitness and prowess. So I think it would be an amazing first step. And this is the next question, would be how do we handle that on the front end? What's the upfront investment required on the fire service through physical fitness and proper hydration levels? Maybe you can speak on that next. Because if I'm hitting a core temperature of, say, 103, but my peer who's less conditioned, not is somebody who only drinks coffee and all the energy drinks, and they're at a 103, is it the same or is that different? Because yes, from what I'm reading, I should have a slower rise to core temp if I'm more physically fit. I'm able to handle the emotional and adrenal stress. Maybe you can split that out for me.
All of those things are correct when you're not wearing PPE.
Okay.
So when you're not wearing PPE, yes. I mean, there are examples of cyclists who reach a core temperature of 40 degrees or 104 or 5 or whatever that might be, and they're still able to exercise, things like that. The problem arises with PPE is that there really is no acclimation to that type of heat stress. So for instance, if someone's really lean, for example, we find that they actually heat up quicker. Mm-hmm. Okay. Fat acts as an insulator. So basically what happens is when someone has excess fat, it takes a little bit longer for that heat to escape the body and then enter into the microclimate. When someone's lean, that heat will escape into the microclimate quicker. And so, yes, I mean, if you're outside and ability to deal with heat and you're leaner and you can remove heat faster, great. Problem with the PPE is it acts as a wall, right? And that heat stress and that, you know, everyone, doesn't matter if you're lean, doesn't matter if you're in shape. I mean, obviously, if you come, one of the best defenses for this type of heat stress is hydration status, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. If someone is hydrated, it's going to delay the impact for sure. But in terms of, you know, heating up quicker and things like that, yeah, if you're dehydrated, you're gonna heat up quicker and it could result in complications earlier. What I've been saying several times now though is that PPE creates a wall, and really, you know, from my standpoint, it doesn't really matter who you are. You're eventually, if you stay in that environment for long enough, you're going to reach an incredibly detrimental heat stress scenario.
Yeah. Okay. I appreciate that differentiation. Yeah. Once you hit certain numbers, like you're hitting it and there's not a whole lot you can control. Now, what about being in the environments through, preparing for the environments through physical fitness, but also heat acclimation strategies. So hot water immersion, the like dry saunas, things like that. The way I interpret it, it would seem as if once you become more acclimated to these environments, your resting state going into the environments is now lower. And so your breadth and depth to be able to handle that, maybe there's a slower rise compared to somebody who's not as heat acclimated. Is that correct?
Yeah, you will probably delay the impacts, but I mean, you'll delay it by a bit.
Okay.
The reality is you're still going to get there relatively quickly.
Okay.
Okay. But being hydrated, being in shape and things like that are definitely going to help you on the front end for sure.
Okay, great. A quick rabbit hole before we get into the decision-making side of things, more of the medical side. Again, some of those Maydays being cardiac, but then also diabetic in nature, is there is a more exponential increase in ATP usage. You're burning off glucose faster. So can you confirm that? And then what is actually happening? Are we burning off more ATP because of the superheat environments, because of, like you said, the microclimates being in PPE? Is that higher metabolic burden kind of placing us in a position where we may, even if it's not a diabetic episode, we're just burning off our energy stores quicker, meaning we may experience complete loss of work capacity and energy. Severe cases, you start seeing rhabdomyolysis. Is that a thing that we actually have to worry about and we need to keep in the back of our mind?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing that you need to take into account for here is that when you're in that environment where you're in a hyperthermic environment, you're wearing PPE, a large portion of your blood is going to make its way to the periphery, to the skin level, in order to try and expel that heat. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're going to lose that heat, or you're going to lose a large portion of the blood flow is going to make its way to that area, which is going to compromise your working muscles. So there'd be less blood flow that will go to your working muscles. And so from the standpoint of oxygen availability, okay, oxygen availability, there's going to be less oxygen available to actually go to the working muscles and be used to create ATP via the aerobic pathways. Mm-hmm. So what'll happen is earlier on, you're going to start to rely on anaerobic pathways. And so glucose is going to be burned off at a faster rate because of the fact that you're not going to be able to create as much ATP to sustain your exercise. And so you're going to be in a higher exercise state from the standpoint where you're going to be in an anaerobic state earlier, because of the fact that you have less blood flow available to the working muscles in order to sustain exercise. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's something actually, one of my like next things that I'm putting out there on the podcast explains the metabolic pathways. And that was part of my call to action. And you explained it in a way that was much clearer. And it also had like some subset information that made more even sense for me. Again, my call to action being, yes, you need to be aerobically fit, but so much of the fire service, because of the work demands that we have, and then also the PPE stress, would be you need to know what anaerobic work capacity feels like and then train for that to help prop up those systems So that way, when you are redlining, which is very common for us, the first time you feel that is not in a true ideal age fire ground environment. You know, feel that out in the weight room prior to that, train those systems so that way you can use them more efficiently when you actually are in the bad environment, so to speak.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the major issues is that, I mean, I've ran into a lot of firefighters who are not in great shape.
Yes.
And I mean, I think that's a major problem.
Absolutely.
Number one killer of firefighters is cardiovascular disease, and cancer is also becoming a major player.
Yeah.
And so I think one of the, you know, I can't say for sure, but I think one of the reasons why cardiovascular disease is a major issue is because, well, one, the cardiovascular system is so strained during these events. And if someone is not prepared, you know, from a physical standpoint, I think they put themselves in a much greater detrimental state than if they were in shape and if they've been training. So,
yeah. Yeah. That's been part of also the call to action. And I've been, you know, talking and discussing Whoop and Apple Watch. A lot of the lab settings and the research are showing that, you know, you're hitting heart rates of 160 up. You maybe if you're for METs, you're producing METs. Some of the research is 12 to 16 METs is very common. And from what I'm seeing from real world data that I'm collecting from myself and from colleagues on Maydays, line of duty deaths, near misses, or just really challenging fire events, is that we're getting well above 16 METs of work. If you're using Whoop in 20 minutes on a 21 scale, we're reaching 1920, heart rates in the 190s. And nothing against the lab settings at all. Now there's like true adrenaline because we're not in the training environments. And so just, yeah, the metabolic burden that we have is just super great. And it's awesome to overlay what the research is telling us, plus some of the real world metabolic data now that we're getting. It's just, yeah, the burden on us is insane.
Yeah, and the beautiful thing is you know, with the system that I'm developing, is you can add predictive core temperature into that as well, and you can see how hot an individual is getting, because yes, heart rate is high and all these things are great to measure, but it's incredibly important to see how hot someone is so we can prevent heat illness. And obviously, and also, you know, referring back to my research, when someone heats up quickly and they get to these certain states around, you know, 38.5 degrees Celsius, when they get there quickly, their cognition starts to suffer.
Yeah.
And when someone's cognition starts to suffer, you know, I would assume, I mean, I'm not a firefighter, but I would assume that when you go into a fire, there are standard procedures that you follow, you know, in terms of, you know, you do this, you do this, you do this. But what if something goes wrong? What if something, you know, what if something happens and you have to make critical, complex decisions? I mean, if your cognition is compromised at that point, I think not only do you put yourself in danger, but if you're doing a life-saving event, you'll also put that individual in danger as well. I think it's incredibly important to see also how hot people are, and measuring core temperature directly, it's just not practical in the environment, because you can't use a rectal thermistor among firefighters. You can't have them swallow an $80 core temperature capsule every single day. So we need these predictive systems, just like the Whoop and just like Apple Watches, and how they have algorithms built in, which are being used to to figure out what someone's heart rate and what someone's VO2 is and things like that. We also need to start looking at heart rate and we need to start looking at core temperature. How hot are these individuals getting? And I think it's incredibly important for firefighters, for military, for occupational workers who work in hyperthermic environments, because of the high rates of heat illness and among your group, the firefighters, the need to have cognition intact in order to make decisions while under this type of stress.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really looking forward to seeing this technology come out from you all. This will be an amazing metric to overlay with all this other stuff and just see how that's affecting us. I'm really looking forward to that. And that's a great segue. So to back up, yes, when we're under that emotional stress, we have the hormonal dump. I have certainly experienced it on a number of incidents. when the central, when the sympathetic nervous system is taxed, like we start experiencing loss of fine motor skills. We're getting auditory exclusion. We're getting the tunnel vision. And then just seeing the pathways of what is happening to the HPA axis, the prefrontal cortex. I know that you are dealing with, the whole brain wave, like theta waves was like something completely new to me. Let's dig in on that because prefrontal cortex is dealing with high executive function, decision-making, response, judgment. And when we're taxed, what I'm seeing is that we become much more impulsive. We, it to some point become risk averse. There's just like a whole bunch of downstream deleterious effects. So now take us down this road. Because this is where, you know, this is where I see firefighters when we're in these terrible environments and we become too task saturated, we get the hormonal dump. We have firefighters that are gonna rip their face pieces off. They take their gloves off in these superheated environments because there's not rational thinking anymore. So yeah. Let's nerd out on that now. Like, please take us down this road.
Yeah. And so where I'll start with this is we as human beings make two types of decisions. We make either type one or type two decisions. Type one decisions are like gut hunch decisions that you just make really without processing. Type two decisions are more complex in nature. They require complex cognitive processes and that's where the prefrontal cortex really comes into play. And you mentioned theta power. So yes, I've shown that when a firefighter heats up quickly in their personal protective equipment, theta power is compromised. Well, theta power is associated with cognitive control. Cognitive control is incredibly important for type two decisions. You need to have cognitive control in order to make these type two decisions effectively. As I mentioned earlier, when a firefighter shows up to a scene, typical procedures, it probably clockwork, bang, 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 bang. You show up, you do this, you do this, you do this, and then you enter. Problem arises when you have to make complex type decisions or these type two decisions in that environment. And the theta power and the change in theta power that I've shown demonstrates that the ability to make these complex decisions become compromised. And I mean, I've been interviewing firefighters recently, and what one of these complex scenarios, and I would have never thought this to be a thing, but is when you enter into a hoarder situation and you go, okay, this is what I would usually do when I enter a fire. Now that I'm in a hoarder situation, really there's one way in and one way out, right? So you need to start thinking, how am I going to deal with this event? Well, if you are extremely hot and you've had a rapid increase in core temperature, your ability to navigate that environment might become compromised. So yeah, looking at from the type two standpoint, it becomes incredibly important when these complex type scenarios come into play. The prefrontal cortex, as you mentioned, plays a major role in processing these complex decisions. So what happens is we start in, you mentioned the sympathetic nervous system, or you mentioned the autonomic nervous system. But what happens is there's a sympathetic response. The sympathetic response causes us to do things like you mentioned without really processing properly. And one of my favorite things that I found recently, I published it in a paper, I believe this year, was that firefighters, when they undergo this rapid heat stress, their reaction time increases. Yeah. Their reaction time decreases. It decreases. And everyone would go, yay, it decreases. That's a good thing. Obviously, this heat stress is helping them it is helping their reaction time. But pair that reaction time with, and this is what I did, pair that reaction time with a decision-making piece, right? Their reaction time is based on a certain decision. Well, guess what? Their decision-making ability becomes terrible. So they're making decisions rapidly, but the decisions that they're making are terrible.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you read the research. Yes, heat stress causes this decrease in reaction time. Well, that's all great. But when you look at the decisions that they're making, the reaction time decisions that they're making, they are making poor decisions. And that's because of an increased sympathetic response. It's causing them to that dump is causing them to react in a way that they probably wouldn't react had they been cooler.
So. Yeah, no, absolutely. I love that explanation. Thank you for that. This is all super exciting to me. So when you overlay, there's a bunch of different stress and performance models, like the inverted U with the optimal levels of arousal. There's Yerkes Dodson and Grossman's and Bruce Siddle's. There's a couple ones out there. And I think that overlays really cleanly, as cleanly as it can be for these, you know, non-controlled environments, where when you reach these task saturated points and you're in high heat environments and you are in a position where, like, hey, the decision I'm about to make is life or death, at least in my mind, in my opinion, the decrease in reaction time can be a negative mark against you when you are literally performing something where you have to perform a life-saving technique for yourself or another team member. I just spoke with someone earlier this week involved in a Mayday, super high heat environment. His friend had to come find him. It was near flashover conditions. And this was basically, they went just a like primal state thinking. And it was almost as if he was like in a sleep state because he was so task saturated. He was incredibly burdened. And then it wasn't until his friend found him up on the third floor. He's like, hey, I got you. We need to come out this way. This is our exit. Did he like basically come back online? So I think that decrease in reaction time is absolutely a mark against us when we are in these environments. Maybe the routine, quote unquote, bread and butter fires that we have, not so much. And it's good to be able to control that thinking status. But I'm talking the Mayday, the near miss, the line of duty, or maybe we're rescuing a civilian or a baby. That's when our heart rates are getting really jacked. That's when we're incredibly task saturated. We're mentally and physically taxed. And that strain on the prefrontal cortex and that cortisol and epinephrine dump is just stroking at such a high level that most aren't used to.
Yeah. And I mean, the cortisol, you know, increased cortisol, you know, the acute increasing cortisol is also linked to cognitive decrements as well. And it's, you're right. I mean, it's, and I have never been in a fire. I'm not a firefighter, but I have been really, really hot wearing firefighter PPE. Mm-hmm. And your ability to, I mean, even in a lab environment, your ability to think, your ability, you go into this stance of, I'm in danger. My core temperature, I mean, I'm hot. And you cannot think effectively. And I don't care who you are. I don't care if you've been a firefighter for 20 years and you've seen this scenario many, many times. You know, as you just stated, you're going to become compromised. And that rapid decision or that rapid reaction time is not a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. No, thank you for that. If we could, we'll take a little bit of a hard right turn since we're kind of hitting on the fatigue stuff. Now, I personally have not dug into the deep parts of your research yet. I've kind of just reading the abstracts on some of the research you've done on fatigue. I think it was mostly more so the wildland firefighters in Canada, but I'm seeing some maybe correlates between fatigue on the fire ground or in the wildland environment, and then maybe how much experience they have. My interpretation was, a lot of times it could help you stave off some of the post-work decrements that some might experience, the more experience that you have. But if you could, it's a wide paintbrush stroke. The back end effects of fatigue in the work that we do and what are some of the attributes that help us get through those states when we're maybe out of these bad environments.
So you're talking about like when you exit a structure and you're incredibly fatigued, what do you do?
Yeah. I think some of your research dealt with like the back end stress, the back end fatigue. Firefighters that had more experience were able to deal with those effects better than maybe non-experienced. And maybe I'm talking out of turn or I misinterpret that incorrectly. But if you could explain that.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, experience definitely plays a part. I mean, experience, physical fitness levels, all these pieces play a role in recovery. And you're right. I mean, some of our wildland stuff, we've definitely found out that experience plays a role in dealing with the back end stresses of these 14 day deployments and things like that. And so, you know, obviously in the West Coast, which is where I did my PhD, there's these incredibly long wildland fires, and I mean they go out on these 14 day deployments and they can be incredibly taxing. And so, but yeah, experience level, physical fitness levels, all of these play a major part in dealing with that type of stress for sure.
Yeah. And I'm sorry to back up. There's one thing I wanted to hit on, and maybe you already did it with the salvatory cortisol. That's one of your testing procedures. And so you're finding, kind of going back to some of the prefrontal cortex stuff and decision-making, that when we're in these bad environments, you're recording that these cortisol levels are much higher than standard or norm, right? Like, how are you, could you explain like how you're actually doing that and how that's recorded and that effect?
Yes, we've measured salivary cortisol among firefighters. And what we do is we've tested them in a control state at same time of day, because cortisol has a diurnal variation with it. And so we test them the same time of day. We have them in, shorts and a t-shirt and a backpack to simulate the weight of the PPE. And we have them exercise in a laboratory environment. And then we do the same tests while wearing PPE, same time of day, same exercise protocol, but just adding on the PPE. What we find is there's this rapid or this exponential increase in cortisol when wearing the PPE, whereas there's not when you're not wearing the PPE. And so, what that tells us, that every time a firefighter goes into one of these, whether it be a structured fire or one of these events, they're having this cortisol dump, right? Just these acute acute increases in cortisol release almost become chronic over the course of time. Yeah. In the sense that as a firefighter, you're going to deal with more of these acute increases than I would as a professor. I mean, I sit at my desk and I'm in an air conditioned environment. I mean, I'm in a climate controlled environment. I'm not going to have these acute bouts. Whereas firefighters, you might not think, hey, well, we don't do a lot of structure fires, or we don't do a lot of this. Yes, but you're wearing your PPE to car wrecks. You're dealing with these events on a more regular basis than the average person. And I think that plays a major role in the development of cardiovascular disease as well. Because atherosclerosis, the plaque buildup in arteries, is highly linked to cortisol. Chronic increases in cortisol are linked to the development of cardiovascular disease. I think that might be one of the reasons why cardiovascular disease is among one of the major killers of firefighters.
Yeah, 100%. I really appreciate you saying that. Some of the back end stuff I do also is dealing with the physical and mental health aspects, and not being able to recover between calls. Or as you just mentioned, every time we get in gear, there is a bit of a cortisol rise, the cortisol dump. And, some of our companies that we deal with, we're running 20 incidents in a 24-hour shift. So not having that period where we can allow that cortisol to come down, or some people just don't even deal with it. And there are absolute links to, like you said, cardiovascular disease, just general overall immunity. And then even the mental health side, the constant cortisol release, the HPA axis constantly getting used up and burnt up because of the cortisol. Like, that's where we're starting to see the mental health side of things as well. And now it's much more widely researched and prevalent. I think that is another contributor to some of the mental health aspects on top of the physical health aspects as well, for sure.
Yeah. Did you say 20 incidents in a 24-hour shift?
Oh yeah. So some of our, where I work, I'm in the Mid-Atlantic, right in smack dab between DC and Baltimore. We'll even run with Baltimore. And where I work, the adjacent where I used to volunteer, that jurisdiction is the 16th busiest in the nation. And so some of the companies that I'm at, now where I'm assigned in downtown Columbia, Maryland. Our medic unit will run about 4,300 incidents a year. I'm on a ladder truck now, so I'm a little bit slower, but it might be, you know, in the mid 1,000s to 2,000s. But a lot of our engine companies, our top five or six engine companies, are 3,500 to 4,000 runs a year. So it's nothing to run. I mean, on the low side, these engine companies and ambulances, eight upwards of 20 incidents in a 24-hour shift. And we do that 24/7, 365. And that's not uncommon, especially when you look at some of the busier departments like Baltimore City, 5,000, 7,000 runs a year, Washington, D.C., a lot of these companies that we run mutual aid with. Yeah, just the burden in a 24-hour shift is super high. And that's totally normal for us.
Yeah, think of the, like, as you mentioned, cortisol, but also think of the sympathetic response every time.
Yeah.
Bang, bang, bang. Think of that. I mean, that is incredibly taxing. That's incredibly taxing to the cardiovascular system. I mean, it's, that's remarkable. I mean, in Shreveport, Louisiana, I don't think they deal with those kind of calls. I mean, that many.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and the American Fire Service and the Canadian Fire Service, everybody's so different. Just within my county, it's 260 square miles. We have 14, almost 15 fire companies. One company might run, you know, they're 20 minutes away. They might run two incidents in a shift, whereas the one in the core of the county, yeah, 20 plus in a shift. So it's wow. It's widely varied, but it's definitely still very prevalent. You know, with that stress response, like, so I just got off this morning, and last night, I think, so we have two ambulances, an engine and a ladder truck. And I think the bells went off from 11 o'clock at night till 7 a.m. this morning. The bells went off probably five separate times. Every unit got up at least once, if not multiple times. And that's pretty common, right? So my 48 hours off now sometimes is spent in recovery. And I know, especially for like the paramedics who are taking the brunt of it, there's a lot there. There's one thing I wanted to touch on when it comes to recovery, is HRV. And so some of the things I'm seeing with HRV, heart rate variability, it's not something widely discussed in the fire service. And I'm now wearing a WHOOP and paying more attention to it and all the things that affect it. It is not uncommon for me to hear firefighters who, whether or not they're physically fit, whether or not they're on certain medications, their physical fitness status, hydration, sleep. You know, we want, generally speaking, HRV levels in triple digits, I think, would be a decent recommendation. But I'm seeing firefighters that'll come to me, hey man, like I've got an HRV of 20 and that's just where I live. And that's like a major red flag, right? Could you just explain what HRV is, why it's important, and what things that affect it, and what you're finding in your research?
Yeah. I mean, heart rate variability is, you know, as you mentioned, it's important to have higher rates of heart rate variability. I mean, that's a sign of a healthy cardiovascular system. HRV is analyzed really in two different ways. You can analyze it in the time domain, and what they do is they measure, or what we do is we measure the time between Rs. Okay, when if you look at a QRS complex on an ECG rating, we measure the time between Rs, and so you want there to be variability among that. So that's one way to analyze it. The other way to analyze heart rate variability is in the frequency domain. So you can pull apart, you can pull out the different frequencies of the waves. And what you can do is you can get low frequency waves and you can get high frequency waves, and then a combination of low frequency and high frequency. Well, a low frequency response has been linked in the literature to like an increased sympathetic response. And high frequency, well, although, you know, not necessarily as established, has kind of been linked to the parasympathetic response. And so the you know, depending on how you look at it, okay, again, if you measure heart rate variability in the frequency domain and you have an increased you have a large amount of low frequency activity, basically what that means, you have an increased sympathetic response. Okay, that's great. That just shows that the fire alarm went off and you're getting ready to go, and you know, or you're hot or you're under some sort of stressful environment. I mean, you can measure that, you know, on the back end for sure.
Yeah.
But the RR, I think that's the measurement between Rs, okay, which, and I'm not sure what the Whoop does, because I think it gives you a score based on how variable those R to Rs are.
I'm guessing. I think it's how regular and consistent it is over the 24-hour period. I don't think it does as good of a job for the acute incidents. But over a 24-hour incident, like, I know that if I'm dehydrated, I haven't been sleeping well, maybe I've been drinking alcohol, like on my day off or whatever, dinner or whatever, you know, it'll drop, and that score might be in the 60s. And like I said, other firefighters, they're going through energy drinks. I've had some tell me that, like, SSRIs and other things that are affecting them physiologically, metabolically, it is starting to drop these scores, and they're like, I just live at a 20. And I don't know if that is a Whoop score, if that's like a general industry standard or metric. I'm not as familiar, but to have a low HRV and to have a dysregulated, it's not a clean beat, and that's, it's not regular, right? It's yeah. Dysregular well, is where you start to see issues.
You actually want there to be variability between those RR intervals.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. like you want the variability to you don't want it to be it. You don't want your heart rate variability to be low as you mentioned.
Yeah.
Right. And so usually, again, what that tells us is that there's something going on from a stress standpoint, cardiovascular standpoint, there's some sort of an issue with someone's heart rate variability is low like that. It means that something's going on, right? There's some sort of stress event. I mean, probably heading towards some sort of cardiovascular issue down the road. So if someone is talking about, you know, their heart rate variability levels being suboptimal on a regular basis, I would address that from the standpoint of probably increase what you're doing on the back end from a recovery standpoint. Are you exercising? Are you recovering properly? I mean, taking, you know, energy drinks and these things. Hey, I mean, like I said, my whole family works in the construction business. They all drink energy drinks like crazy. But that is going to put you in a position where you're just not going to be healthy. So.
Yeah. No, thank you for that explanation. That was a much cleaner way of presenting that. And that's something that just rampant caffeine use and the energy drinks and the nicotine pouches and all kinds of stuff is rampant in the fire service. And I do think that's playing an effect. So thank you for that. Again, I want to be respectful of your time. I know we're coming up on an hour. I feel like I could talk to you for hours. Like I'm really enjoying this conversation and the research that you're doing. It has so much value. So thank you for that. As we wrap up, I know we've just hit on a couple of things with the heat stress, decision-making under stress, and some of those metabolic factors. Anything that I've missed, like your favorite research, or is there any call to action, or is there something that we haven't touched on that you find super valuable, important that for the fire service that we haven't hit on as we kind of wrap this up?
Yeah. I mean, I think we've hit on it. It's firefighters need to be healthier. They need to spend more time working on physical health, mental health. They need to make sure that they're putting themselves in the best possible scenario, because firefighting is a high stress job. And maybe firefighters don't realize that, but I guess all you'd have to do is come hang out with me for one day and realize that firefighting is much more physically stressful than what I do. And so realizing that and being prepared, I mean, stay away from excessive alcohol consumption. Stay away. Make sure you're showing up to on shift hydrated, you know, limit your caffeine consumption, all of these pieces. That's going to help you. But also, I think there needs to be more checks and balances in place for firefighters. There needs to be increased physiological monitoring and to really prevent these excessive stressful moments. For instance, right? If you're going into a fire, if we could pull you out before you reach that detrimental core temperature state or that high sympathetic state or whatever it might be, If we can limit those events, limiting of those events is going to have a long-term implications because over the course of time, you're not going to have these excessively elevated stress responses, which are really the major contributors to future cardiovascular disease, future issues. So down the road. So I think, yeah, two things: be healthy and let's increase monitoring to keep you guys safer.
Hell yeah. Straight from the doctor's mouth, man. I really appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you for the research and work you're doing. Like I said, it's been a massive value and importance to me and the circles that I've been in. And I'm just scratching the surface of what you're doing. I printed out pages of what you do, and I still need to dig into more. So thank you for that. I'm really looking forward to the core temp devices that you're putting out there. I'll definitely keep an eye out for that. And I know for whatever we can do, the department I work for is very forward thinking and likes to get out ahead of research. If there's anything that we can do to just help or assist in any way, like, that would be a massive honor, and whatever we can do to help, that'd be super cool.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the things that we're doing is we're really expanding into live firefighting, yeah, live fire training, right? And validating our system in the live environment.
Cool.
So for instance, I mean, just on a basic level, January 7th, I'm going out and I'm collecting a bunch of data during flashover training.
Yeah.
And so things like that. But I mean, if there's ever the opportunity, I'd love to come up there, you know, at some point and collect some data. I mean, at your training center or something like that, I would love to do something like that. You and I can chat about that in the future.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, we actually have our training department does a great job. We actually get real acquired structures, like people will donate, and we have commercial structures, we have old hospitals, we have single family homes, and we actually build them out to make them safer, but then we actually do live burns in them and do real evolutions in these real structures. So it gets us out of the training environment in these brick and mortar, more sterile environments, puts us in more real world environments. And, we go through as real scenarios as we can and try to replicate the real world as much as possible. And we do that we're going through it now. We do it on a somewhat regular basis. And we have a great staff that support that. So that'd be super cool. But, sir, this is fantastic. Thank you so much. What you're doing brings a ton of value. So thank you for doing what you're doing.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate you. I appreciate the opportunity to be on this today. And, you know, obviously I love to spread the word, and this has been a great opportunity. Thank you so much.
Yeah, appreciate that.